Good day. Today is Tuesday, 28th July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, as the hours have passed, we've had a continued trickle of information about the various comments that the Russian President Vladimir Putin made over the course of a whole series of speeches and meetings that took place over the last couple of days. There was firstly his meeting with the top naval commanders, then there was a speech that he gave to the naval commanders, and then there was a further speech that he gave in the St. George's Hall in the Kremlin, the most important ceremonial hall of the Kremlin, to the outgoing deputies of the State Duma, Russia's parliament, which is up for election in September. It is perhaps what he said over the course of the last speech that is most interesting. And again, and very interestingly and tantalizingly, the Kremlin has not provided a complete transcript of his words, though the video of him giving the speech is there on the Kremlin's website. And of course, the Russian media is full of discussion of Putin's comments. Anyway, over the course of this speech, Putin, who appeared, I should say, in an exceptionally relaxed and cheerful and very confident mood, said with great smiles and a mood of apparent elation that a soldier who he had recently decorated for service in the special military operation, after receiving the decoration, had come along and spoken to him and had whispered to Putin that the time had come for Russia to advance further and faster in the zone of the special military operation. And Putin smilingly said, "I also would like that." And the entire hall then bursts into applause. And then after saying this, Putin steps back and he says that the reason it has not been done is because the Russian government, the Russian leadership, the Russian military leadership must balance the pace of advances on the front lines against the level of casualties experienced by the Russian army. Advancing faster and more powerfully, as Putin has made clear he would like, would incur risks and would result in higher casualties. And for the moment, up to now, that change in the balance is one that the Russian leadership, that he himself, have decided not to take. Now, it was a very interesting set of comments, because Putin acknowledged that he is coming under pressure to accelerate the pace of the special military operation, to move it beyond a special military operation, and to repeat again, over the last 2 or 3 weeks, his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has already said that the conflict in Ukraine has moved beyond the bounds of a special military operation. It has instead become an actual war, largely because of the actions of the Western powers. Well, Putin has indicated that it is his own desire that the Russians hit harder and move faster, but that he's held back up to now because of concerns about Russian casualties. And it's perhaps his statement of his desire to move faster and harder that we should note. Because it seems to me that Putin, even as he also said in these same comments, that the important thing for the Russians to do is to move forward consistently and systematically. He has expressed his inner wish, his desire, and he has shared it with the members of the Russian parliament and with the Russian people. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but I interpret these words as indeed a sign that Putin expects that things will indeed start to move faster fairly soon, that the tempo of operations on the front lines is going to accelerate and accelerate markedly. Perhaps more than the actual words he used, but the confident and cheerful way in which he said it conveyed to me the message that this is what he expects to happen, and that this, I suspect, was also the feeling amongst the onlookers in the hall and perhaps amongst those members of the Russian public who viewed this speech on Russian television. Anyway, that is my own take. Others, of course, are entitled to a different view. You might want to argue that Putin was simply defending the original approach. But as I said, to me, the body language seems to point in a different direction. I wonder whether one of the reasons why the Kremlin has been very careful about editing Putin's words over the last few days is precisely because, as is often the way with Putin, his spoken words, the actual words themselves, don't fully match the full force of the meaning behind them, making them difficult to set out in writing in a way that conveys their meaning exactly. Anyway, we shall see. We shall see what happens and how things play out. Now, the other leader who is nominally, at least, on the other side in this war, Vladimir Zelensky, is now either in the United States or travelling there to attend the funeral of Senator Lindsey Graham. And he expects to meet Donald Trump. And we are told that today in the Senate there will be the first vote on the bone-crushing sanctions bill, though apparently Donald Trump still has significant doubts about it, and it's clear that the last word, whatever happens in November, is going to be his. One thing that Zelensky can't really expect from Trump is more weapons. The United States is not in a position to provide more weapons over and beyond those that it is providing to Ukraine. We've had still more information about more US commanders warning President Trump about the critical shortages of weapons in US military inventories. I am confident that any move by Donald Trump to accelerate the flow of weapons to Zelensky and Ukraine, weapons laundered through the Europeans, would provoke a fierce reaction and strong opposition from the Pentagon. I remember about a year ago, long before the conflict with Iran, in fact, even before the US attack on Iran in June 2025, the Pentagon was already telling Trump that air defense missile interceptors were in increasingly short supply and that it would not be a good idea to supply Ukraine with more of them. In fact, there was a Pentagon decision, a decision made by officials within the Pentagon to stop supplying Patriot missile interceptors to Ukraine. This happened, as I said, around a year ago. Then there was the usual litany of complaints from Zelensky, from the Europeans, from people like Lindsey Graham and the other hardliners in Washington. And all sorts of articles appeared in the European and British media disputing the entire claim that there was any real shortage of weapons and of Patriot missile interceptors at all. And I remember that at that time, the British media, or some parts of it, when news of the Pentagon's decision to stop supplying Patriot missile interceptors became public. Anyway, parts of the media in Britain resurrected the old Russiagate narrative that Trump was somehow under Putin's control and that this decision was a result of that. Anyway, the accumulation of all of this, unsurprisingly, caused Donald Trump to reverse course. He had a telephone conversation with Zelensky, over the course of which he first said to Zelensky, if the Russians are attacking Kiev, as you're complaining about, why don't you attack Moscow? Why don't you carry out strikes against Moscow? Triggering the whole process which has led us to the point where strikes against Moscow by Ukrainian drones have now begun, or have now been taking place. And Trump, over the course of this call, also assured Zelensky that Ukraine would indeed be getting Patriot missile interceptors and that he was going to overrule the Pentagon's decision. And indeed, some Patriot missile interceptors were then supplied, but not in the quantities that Zelensky wanted. Well, that was all, as I very well remember, it all happened a year ago. But now, no one in any part of the media, in any part of the Western political world, is any longer disputing that there are indeed shortages of weapons in US inventories, especially of air defense interceptors. No one, except, strangely enough,
Donald Trump himself and his ambassador to the UN, Mike Walsh. They still maintain, in defiance of universally accepted facts, that the United States has a superabundance of every type of weapon, more weapons, in fact, than any other country in the world. And of course, Donald Trump, as we know, always insists that not only does the United States have more weapons than everyone else, but it also has the best weapons, all as a result, supposedly, of the huge increase in defense spending that he carried out when he was president during his first term. Well, Trump himself may express these fictions, but they are fictions. By now, even he certainly knows it. And Zelensky may come and may demand more Patriot missile interceptors and more other types of weapons, precision-guided weapons from the United States, but he isn't going to get any. Trump gave him the license, supposedly, during the NATO summit meeting to manufacture Patriot missiles in Ukraine. I don't think anybody takes that seriously. But realistically, Trump isn't going to be able to go beyond that. But what Zelensky is likely to get from Trump is an overall endorsement of his political and strategic position. The days when Donald Trump went through the motions of putting pressure on Zelensky are far behind us. Back in March of last year, Trump briefly switched off intelligence assistance to Ukraine, which, as we now know, was never entirely switched off, but which was enough to spook Zelensky and the Ukrainians. And Trump got Zelensky to agree to a ceasefire on the existing conflict lines, an idea which up to then Zelensky had consistently resisted. But since then, since that brief flicker of pressure in March 2025, Trump, within the resources that he has essentially given Zelensky everything Zelensky has asked for. He has occasionally had some difficult meetings with Zelensky, as he did apparently in November 2025. But ultimately, as with Joe Biden, Zelensky has always managed to come away getting most, if not all, of what he wants. And all of this, at the moment, very much on the strength of the current narrative, which still is believed by some people, including apparently Donald Trump himself, that Ukraine has turned the tide, that it is actually winning the war, that the Russians are stuck on the front lines, that the Russians are being hammered in the war in the sky, that the Russian losses are on an immense and irreplaceable scale. Putin, in several telephone conversations, has warned Trump that all this that he is being told is untrue, Putin in various conversations, and by the way, at the Anchorage summit meeting, has been careful to try to brief Trump about the actual situation on the front lines. Trump, of course, has paid no attention. What Putin says, in the usual granular detail that Putin goes in for, does not have the effect of the film footage of the smoke coming out of Moscow or the smoke coming from the refineries that Trump sees in Fox News broadcasts. And it doesn't have the vivid quality of what he's been told by members of his inner circle who want him to remain committed to the conflict in Ukraine. So, foolishly, Trump instead has taken to believing what Zelensky is telling him, what the Europeans are telling him, what his intelligence community is telling him, even though, in the main, these are the same people who have told Trump all sorts of things in the past about Iran and who also made up stories back in 2016 about Trump's own relations with the Russians, which turned out to be untrue. Trump's capacity to prefer bad advice to good advice, as I have said in previous programs, borders on genius, and I expect we're going to see it in full force over the next few days. Anyway, there it is. There's going to be this meeting between Trump and Zelensky. The Americans have clearly retreated from the offers they made and got the Russians to accept at Anchorage, at the summit meeting in Alaska last year. The Russians, as I have said already, now believe that this is all a trick to try to work the Russians into accepting a ceasefire on the existing conflict lines, on the presumption that the Anchorage agreements would be implemented. The Russians never fell for that. So Anchorage has failed, and the result is that we've got the coercive diplomacy, if you can call it diplomacy, the assistance to Ukraine to conduct drone and missile attacks onto Russia instead. If you want to read a detailed account of the whole shabby affair from Anchorage right up till today, there's a fine article about it which sets it all out in great detail on Thomas Fazi's Substack site. You can read about it all there, and all I would say is that what you will read conforms fully, in my opinion, with overall Russian thinking. Anyway, put all this aside, let's now go back to Putin, because Putin, we're told by his spokesman, Peskov, has had another important call with a global leader, but then Peskov went further and said further along over the course of his statement to the media that the leader in question was not Donald Trump. There's so far been no requests from the White House for such a telephone call. So it'll be interesting to see who this global leader is going to turn out to be. We will obviously know by tomorrow. I am not going to engage in any speculations in the meantime. Whilst, however, I am on the subject of Peskov, who, as I have said many times, I regard as his loyal master's voice, I believe Peskov accurately reports what Putin is thinking. Anyway, Peskov did say a number of other things. He said that it is now particularly important to complete the tasks of the special military operation, because Zelensky's Ukraine is now obviously a rogue entity. In fact, he went further. He said it is a terrorist entity. Let me repeat again. This is Peskov's words. And that it is a terrorist entity whose terrorism is now spreading around the world. And Peskov alluded to the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines, the attack on the Iranian cargo ship in the Caspian Sea, an incident which has flown completely below my radar. I have entirely missed it. Over the course of which it appears that some Ukrainian intelligence officials or officials of that kind were arrested in India, apparently whilst planning some kind of operation, the details of which I have absolutely no knowledge of. Anyway, those were the incidents that Peskov mentioned. And he said that given the nature of this entity, this terrorist entity, which is the Zelensky government, it is now even more important that all of the goals of the special military operation be fulfilled. Obviously, this entity cannot be allowed to continue to exist. Now, these are very interesting words because, again, they tell us that the Russian objective in the conflict in Ukraine, the ultimate Russian objective, is indeed regime change. And this comes not from Medvedev or Lavrov or Shoigu or other senior Russian spokesmen, but from Putin's own spokesman. I've not myself heard Peskov talk quite in this way before. But, well, we've just had Putin talking about how he would like to see the advance of the Russian army in the territory in Ukraine accelerate, how he would like to see the Russian army go faster and harder. And I've already spoken in the past about the possibility, the recent possibility, after Peskov's previous words about how the conflict between Russia and Ukraine has gone beyond a SMO, the framework of the SMO, and has become an actual war. Well, I've previously spoken about how a possible important upgrade of it would be to a counter-terrorist operation. And, well, here we have Peskov, it seems to me, pointing us clearly in that direction as well. Now, before I move on from what Peskov said, Peskov also turned to the topic of wild berries and the attacks on wild berries. And the Russians have clearly spoken of these attacks as being acts of terrorism on civilian facilities. And the statements of various Ukrainian officials that the purpose of the attacks, the drone attacks now, are to shake the Russian people out of the sense of normalcy that they live in, which you could, I think, make a case is a terrorist objective. After all, what is terrorism if not an attempt to create a climate of terror, something fundamentally different from the ordinary routine life in which we all live? Well, going back to the attacks on wild berries, Peskov said that it's an excellent thing that wild berries is going to provide financial support to the various small businesses whose stock was destroyed in the Ukrainian drone attacks. And he made it fairly clear that what I spoke about before in earlier programs, that the Russian government would also almost certainly provide financial assistance to wild berries to ensure that that happened. Anyway, Peskov said that wild berries and the Russian government are in discussion over this very same thing. The amounts of money needed to compensate the small businesses for their losses would be small change for the Russian finance ministry. It would almost not be a rounding out error, I would guess. The work to rebuild the warehouses would be a lot more expensive, but probably wild berries can afford to do it itself, especially if its insurers agree to make payouts, something which for the moment they are apparently resisting doing. But my own experience is that in these sort of events, there's usually resistance from the insurers. They will cite the fact that this is a military attack and therefore outside the scope of the insurance policy. But there'll be negotiations and there'll be discussions and there'll probably be a certain amount of pressure on the insurers from the Kremlin and the payouts. Perhaps not the full amount of the damage, but a certain payout eventually is going to be made. Anyway, let's move on. So Peskov also dropping very obvious hints that we could be moving towards a counter-terrorism operation. Putin, as I said, saying to the Duma something which to me points in the same direction. Now, I would quickly add a cautionary note. We have been here before. I thought after the attacks on Crocus Hall and the Kursk operation that the Kremlin was already considering upgrading the SMO to a counter-terrorism operation. And Putin did use the word terrorism in connection with both of those incidents. In the event that the upgrade to a counter-terrorism operation that I expected or that I thought might happen did not take place, perhaps it will be the same again. But then, I've never heard Peskov talk in quite this way before, that this is an all-out war and that Zelensky's government is now a terrorist entity. And I've never seen Putin basically tantalize the Duma and the Russian people and perhaps the military about accelerating the pace of the special military operation, of the military advance in Ukraine. I've never seen him do that in quite the way that he has just done. And I do think that does mark a significant change. Well, there is a further reason why the Russians might now be thinking increasingly about an acceleration of the pace of the special military operation. And that is, and an upgrade of the special military operation, putting completely to one side the terrorism issues that I've just been speaking about. These are that the situation on the front lines and in the sky continues to shift lopsidedly, as it always, by the way, does. It has consistently done over the last 3 years, in midsummer, in Russia's favour. We saw this happen in the midsummer of 2024. We saw this happen last year. And we are seeing this happen now. We could potentially see a major breakthrough on the front lines very soon. And we could also potentially see a decisive change in the sky, in the campaign in the sky also. The Russians continue to hammer Odessa. As I've said, this is now a routine thing, but they do so all the time. The Russian Defense Ministry has published extraordinary footage taken from a high-flying drone, presumably a Garand drone, of drone strikes on two dry cargo ships in the port of Nikolaev. The footage is extraordinary to watch, and it says again that these attacks were carried out by Garand 4 drone seeker drones, in other words, optically guided drones, which are jet powered. And well, there've been a series of other attacks on Odessa as well over the last 2 days. I haven't spoken about them, but yesterday the Russian Defense Ministry spoke about how the Russians launched strikes at the ports of Ukraine, used to deliver cargoes to Ukraine, and they continued to strike all sorts of targets in those ports, and they provided lists of the targets that they attack. By the way, they say that the two ships that were attacked in the port of Nikolaev were unloading military cargoes. Again, I'm not there. I can't say necessarily whether that is true or not. But the Russians now continue their systematic attacks on the gasoline stations in eastern Ukraine. They continue their strikes on other facilities in eastern Ukraine. There's a recent complaint on Ukrainian social media that there are now new gas filling stations left in the roads from Poltava to Sumy and Kharkiv, that they've all been destroyed. There's complaints in the Ukrainian media about shortages that are now starting to happen of gasoline in Ukraine. Somebody called Sergei Kuyun, head of the consulting firm A95, says that chronicles of the first week of the fuel crisis, gasoline, it seems there is already a general shortage. Zero displays are lighting up at one gasoline station chain after another. It all stems from the introduction of the E10 standard on July 1st. Domestic production is impossible due to the security situation and an absurd tax system, while foreign suppliers are unable to increase E10 supplies. Well, I don't know what E10 gasoline actually is, but he complains that it provides no benefits to the national economy, leading to price increases. Apparently, there's also supplies of diesel fuel. There are also shortages of these supplies as well. And apparently, I've read now that E10 standard gasoline contains up to 10% bioethanol. This all looks to me like some sort of deal that someone has done. But anyway, what we're starting to see, and I am sure that it is to a great extent connected with these Russian attacks, we're starting to see gasoline shortages begin to happen in Ukraine as well. We have heard a great deal about gasoline shortages in Russia over the last few weeks. However, I noticed that even Zero Hedge is now acknowledging that the gasoline shortages in Russia are now abating. Leonid Rogozin, the strongly anti-Putin Russian journalist who lives and works abroad, he doesn't write from within Russia, but who is, in my opinion, one of the most realistic commentators of the war. He also acknowledges that the gasoline situation in Russia is stabilizing as well. And of course, we have Julian Röpke of Bild Zeitung, German journalist. People often speak of him as a pessimist in discussing Ukraine's overall situation. I think truthful commentator and realist is a more accurate way to describe him. To make it clear, he is fiercely supportive of Ukraine and wants Western aid to Ukraine to be stepped up. But he acknowledges that Ukraine's situation is becoming more and more difficult, even as Donald Trump apparently believes that in backing Zelensky, he is backing a winner. So that is the situation in the sky as of today. There are lots of rumors of a build-up of Russian missiles and drones being readied for another mass strike against Kiev. And there are some reports that residents of Kiev
are already moving into shelters or going out into the streets and moving into tents in advance of this strike, which is supposedly being prepared. We'll see whether or not that is true. We will see also when the Oreshnik starts to be used. I said that the military situation, both in the sky and on the front lines, is shifting increasingly now in Russia's favour. And, well, one of the factors that may be making Putin so confident and so cheerful as he speaks to the Duma is that perhaps the volumes of missiles, Oreshnik missiles, in the Russian inventory and the capabilities of this system have both been improved to the level when strikes using this system can shortly begin. Anyway, that's the situation in the sky. There continue to be important developments on the ground. Now, yesterday, the Russians announced significant advances in the area between the town of Dobropilia, which the Russians, according to all reports, are currently storming, and the city of Konstantinivka. This is exactly that same sector of villages, with perhaps the most important village being Zoloty Kolodyaz, where in the summer of 2025, the Russians achieved a sudden breakthrough which destabilized the Ukrainian defense in Pokrovsk. As I've discussed in a recent program, the now sacked Ukrainian military chief, General Sirsky, blamed the current Ukrainian military chief, General Drapaty, for allowing this breakthrough to take place. There was supposedly a massive row between these two at that time, and Sirsky had to rush to the scene and deploy all sorts of forces from across the contact line, weakening Ukrainian positions in all sorts of places, including in Konstantinivka and Pokrovsk, and perhaps most importantly Siversk, in order to plug this hole in the front lines that the Russians had suddenly created. Anyway, all of these reinforcements that Sirsky sent to this area of villages sufficed first to contain the Russian breakthrough and then gradually to regain control of these villages. Looking back, it was clearly a diversionary operation by the Russians, whose major priority at that time was Pokrovsk, Kupiansk and Siversk. Well, we are now well past that time. The Russians control Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, Siversk and Kupiansk. And the Russians have now returned to this very same area, and they are starting to capture some of the villages in precisely this territory, though not so far Zoloty Kolodyaz itself. Of course, they also control Belitskaya and Rodinska, two towns in this same area, which they also didn't control when they carried out that breakthrough this time last year. But anyway, the Russians are now clearing these villages, and
it's increasingly looking as if this is partly an operation to accelerate the advance into Druzhivka. And of course, the satellite town of Alexeyevo Druzhivka. I probably got the name of that town wrong. Anyway, I never quite capture it. But anyway, the attack on that town is also now apparently taking place. Reports speak of the Russians well inside the town. And anyway, we can see that the situation along the southern flank of the chain of fortified cities, basically now confined to Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, is becoming worse for the Ukrainians, seemingly by the hour. The Russians are gradually taking Kramatorsk itself into a vice. They're starting to encircle Kramatorsk. Obviously, they will have to capture Druzhivka first, but they are now on the eastern outskirts of Kramatorsk. And once they've captured Dobropilia, and once they've also captured this line, this cluster of villages, they will be able to advance and attack Kramatorsk also from the west. Now, the big puzzle and mystery is what exactly is happening in Liman. The Russian military have still not announced the capture of Liman, even though lots of reports have spoken about this town being under Russian control, essentially under Russian control, well, for well over a month now. And about 6 weeks ago, Gerasimov, the Russian overall commander, said that the Russians controlled 25% of Liman. And a couple of days ago, he said that organized resistance by the Ukrainians in Liman had been broken. And we continue to receive every day more reports on the Russian Defense Ministry's website about how the Russians basically control Liman. So this is a report which has just come out from the Russian Defense Ministry within the last few hours. And it says this: the chief of staff of the 37th Regiment with the call sign Zhara spoke about the successes in the Krasny Liman direction. Krasny Liman is the name the Russians give to Liman. The regiment mops up and secures the city. Drone operators are already operating beyond Krasny Liman. Our drone operators inflict fire damage on the enemy beyond Krasny Liman in order to break his logistics and continue our offensive towards Slavyansk and Raigorodok. And this is all very interesting because it tells us that the Russians, once they've captured Liman, are indeed going to advance beyond Liman to the town of Raigorodok, which lies almost equal distance between Slavyansk and Liman. When the Russians captured Liman for the first time back in May 2022, there were lots of chatter and speculation about whether they would advance further. And when the attack on Raigorodok
would take place. But in fact, it never did take place because, as we now know, the Russians didn't have enough troops in the area to carry out that attack. And their major priority at that time was the capture first of Mariupol and then of Severodonetsk and Lysychansk. But now the situation is completely different. The Russians are present in the Liman area in much greater force. They control Siversk, which is located to the east of Liman, which they did not control in 2022. They control Bakhmut and Soledar and Chasiv Yar and Konstantinovka to the south, and Toretsk as well, I should say. So they control all of these places, which they didn't control then. Their positions are far more solidly anchored. If they do hold Liman, then it's difficult to see that there is much that would stop them from advancing further and capturing Raigorodok. And somewhat to the south, there are indeed finally reports this morning that the Russians have indeed entered the fortified village of Nikolaevka, and that there is indeed active fighting going on in that village and in the Slavyansk thermal power plant, all of which brings the Russians very close to Slavyansk itself. Now, I suppose many people not particularly interested in these events, these battles for small villages and small towns, though Dobropilia, at 28,000 people before the war, is, well, it's a town. It may not be a very big one, but it's still a town. It's about the same size. Liman was about the same size, just saying. Konstantinovka was much larger, and apparently, before the start of the special military operation, its population was estimated at around 70,000. But in the last days of the Soviet Union, Konstantinovka had a population of well over 100,000 and was considered an important industrial area in Donbass. So, you know, one can overstate the supposedly diminutive size of these places. But all of this adds up, as I said already, to an operation to encircle Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, and the Ukrainian forces which are defending them, and to break Ukrainian defences in Donbass, and, as I've discussed in many programmes, after Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, after Dobropilia, there is open country. Stanislav Krapivnik put it best when he said that before, whenever the Ukrainians were fighting for one town in Donbass, there was always another town behind it that they could fall back on. So behind Soledar, there was Bakhmut. Behind Bakhmut, there was Chasiv Yar. Behind Chasiv Yar, there were Kramatorsk and Konstantinovka. There was also Toretsk.
Now, beyond Dobropilia, Slavyansk, and Kramatorsk, there is nothing but open plains. So, at least open plains, until you start reaching larger places like Lazova, Pavlograd, and eventually the Dnieper itself. So the entire character of the war changes. And when Putin talks about acceleration, about more rapid movements, well, you can see why. Because with the line of the fortified cities gone, the space for that faster movement begins to appear. It's the moment, perhaps, when you can start to unleash mechanized forces, tank and armored vehicle armies. These would now be protected by drones to a degree that was not the case before. So you would no longer have columns of tanks and armored vehicles exposed to attack by drones without protection. The Russians have moved hugely forward in providing drone protection for armored forces and indeed for their infantry on the front lines. So it's absolutely possible that the pace of an offensive would then increase by orders of magnitude. Now, this is not the only place where the Russians are achieving breakthroughs. I discussed yesterday in my program the situation in Zaporozhye region, the fact that the Russians have captured more places in eastern Zaporozhye region, which looks as and the fact that the various Ukrainian counterattacks in this area appear to have been defeated. There's also more information about a critical situation for the Ukrainians in Kharkiv region. There's been reports from various Russian channels about Russian forces having now broken into the small town of Beli Kolodias from the east. The Russians already have a presence in Beli Kolodias, on the western part of Beli Kolodias, but I've said that the Russians appear to have mostly encircled that small town. It looks as if it's now being stormed from two directions, so it's likely to fall very soon. By the way, a bizarre video has appeared purporting to show a Russian soldier waving a flag, somewhat to the west, oh, no, sorry, somewhat to the east of Beli Kolodias. The Russian soldier, I believe, is about 5 meters tall or something ridiculous. He's a giant. Obviously, it is a AI generated film. It is not on the video, oh, sorry, it is not in the Telegram channels of either the Russian Defense Ministry or of Group of Forces North. I suspect it's a piece of Ukrainian disinformation in order to create the impression that Russian claims to be advancing in this area are untrue. But most of the information, in fact, nearly all of the information about Russian advances in this area comes from Group of Forces North. And as I've discussed many times, Group of Forces North has a most interesting Telegram channel, one with its own distinct personality, and one which overall I have consistently found reliable. So when they say that they achieved these advances, I generally credit them. Anyway, the key thing here is that the fall of Belikolodias and other Russian advances in Kharkov region also, and west of Kupiansk all seem to point to an imminent collapse of Ukrainian resistance in northeastern Kharkov region, in this actually very large area of Ukraine. Now, all of this is going on, and it does beg the question of what Ukraine's military leadership is doing. Whatever one may have thought of General Sirski, I always got the sense, whilst he was in charge, that there was someone in charge. You might take strong issue with his decisions. I felt many times that he was launching wholly inappropriate counterattacks, which simply bled the Ukrainian army dry. And I also felt that his tendency to give stand and fight orders in impossible situations often lacked rationality behind them. But there was no doubt at all that there was an active intelligence running the Ukrainian military. And I should say something else. One of the things that, looking back, is now quite striking is that when the first Ukrainian overall military commander, General Zaluzhny, was sacked by Zelensky. By the way, he wasn't the first Ukrainian commander. Zaluzhny took over from another commander who Zelensky also sacked. But I don't remember the name of this, but this happened very early on in the special military operation. Anyway, when Sirski took over from Zaluzhny, one sensed that there was an entirely smooth transition, which makes me wonder whether in reality Sirski, who was nominally Zaluzhny's ground force commander, wasn't the person who was to a great extent running things all along, certainly after the failure of the Ukrainian counteroffensive in Zaporozhye in the summer of 2023. Anyway, this time, I'm not really getting the sense that General Drapaty is getting a grip on the situation. The Russians, in their various commentaries about Drapaty, say that he is a very hardline nationalist, that he is very close to the ultra-nationalist wing in Ukrainian politics, but that he is also favoured by the pro-Western NGOs and their supporters in Kiev, but that he does not have the capacity for high command. Well, it's early days, and perhaps we're going to see
Draupadi appear and make just take decisive steps and show that he is indeed in control. But so far, what I'm actually seeing on the front lines is an accelerated crumbling with no one apparently, no visible sign that anybody at the center in Kiev is making decisions. The brilliant US commentator on Ukrainian related matters, Gordon Hahn, has now produced his own superb analysis about the recent political crisis in Ukraine, about the fall of Fyodorov, and then the fall of Sirsky, and the emergence of Khama, the SBU chief, the former SBU chief, and special and covert operations officer as Ukraine's defense minister, and of Draupadi as the ground forces commander. His analysis in many respects overlaps with my own. Like me and others, Gordon Hahn also thinks that Fyodorov was overselling the effectiveness of Ukraine's drone offensive, and that the uniformed military were becoming increasingly unhappy about the misallocation of resources, and that this was what precipitated the crisis. And Gordon Hahn also makes the absolutely valid overall point that the ultimate story behind this crisis is of the developing crisis of the Ukrainian army, that its shortages of personnel, which mean that it is increasingly incapable of holding positions in the face of the advancing Russians, and more gaps being created on the front lines, and of the increasingly urgent demands from the military for fiercer, even fiercer and more brutal mobilization than what we have seen in Ukraine up to now. And I completely agree with all of this. By the way, Zelensky, in his stopover trip to Britain, where he signed the deal on the drone factory and met with Andy Burnham, Zelensky gave an interview to the British media. And I noticed, and again, the media in Britain don't seem to have understood the significance, but Zelensky spoke about the need to increase mobilization, the pace of mobilization in Ukraine, how this is the priority. Solving the mobilization issue is the priority at the moment. Just saying. But anyway, going back to Gordon Hahn. Gordon Hahn appears to believe that Draupadi, who clearly has strong connections with the ultra-nationalist faction in Ukraine, is basically a compromise figure between the more conventional military and the leaders of the Azov movement, the Azov brigades, the two Azov brigades, who ultimately want their chief, Andrei Belitsky, to take over as Ukraine's military chief. And Gordon Hahn predicts that in time, that is precisely what is likely to happen. That Belitsky totally lacks any command training at all, that he has basically acquired his experience as a brigade commander on the fly, obviously isn't something that will deter this attempted takeover by the ultra-nationalists of the entire Ukrainian movement, military forces, security forces. Because, of course, what drives these people, first and foremost, is ideology, their mission to recreate Ukraine according to their image, rather than the objective needs of the war. And, well, I strongly suspect that Gordon Hahn is right. And Gordon Hahn also points to the increasing power within the military intelligence and security apparatus of people from the world of covert activity and intelligence. Yevgeny Khana, the new defense minister, who is a SBU, covert operations officer. He is the man who's credited with masterminding Operation Spider's Web, the attack on the Russian strategic air bases, and who's probably the person who was behind many of the other covert operations inside Russia, which were carried out by the SBU. He, of course, is now the defense minister. You could add Kirill Budanov, the former head of military intelligence, who's carried out all kinds of special operations and covert operations himself, and who is now, of course, Zelensky's chief of staff. And perhaps the most sinister figure of all, Poklad, who is now the acting head of the SBU, an individual with a particularly dark reputation. It's been discussed extensively by events in Ukraine, which has alleged that he has former background in the Ukrainian city of Kremenchuk, that he's formerly been involved and has acted as an enforcer for Ukrainian organized crime networks. And, well, others like Gordon Hahn, and I have noticed other Ukrainian commentators as well, have also spoken about Poklad's reputation and his various alleged activities. Now, to be very clear, when talking about Poklad, I'd not heard about him until a few months ago when Zelensky promoted him to a senior position in the SBU. So all of these stories about Poklad are very recent ones that have come to my attention. I have heard nothing about them until a few months ago. But then I've not seen any real information to contradict them either. I've not seen anybody come out, for example, with a resounding defense of Poklad's reputation and character.
So Gordon Hunt puts all this together and he says that we are in a situation where the Ukrainian government is evolving in a very dark direction. And can one really dispute this? And, well, we have this crisis on the front lines. Ukraine carried out another massive drone attack on Russia last night. Word is that the Russians managed to bring down nearly all the drones and that minimal damage was done. So Zelensky, no doubt being very well received by Trump and all of the others in Washington, he received all the support he could have possibly dreamed of and wanted from Prime Minister Burnham in London. But I do wonder, in the end, how much good it is all going to do. And in the meantime, Putin looking cheerful and confident, talking about an acceleration of the Russian advance. Peskov talking about Ukraine as a rogue entity. Zelensky's Ukraine as a rogue entity. Well, you can put together the pieces how you wish, but I think I've made fairly clear how they look to me in this programme. Well, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop where we're holding a sale at the moment. Links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.